Welcome back to Feet First, a podcast focusing on the front of the pack in the UK trail and ultra running scene. Back with another episode from our 2026 Arc of Attrition coverage. This is the final episode dropping this week, featuring a conversation with Harry Jones, which we had before the Arc of Attrition 50 miler. I don't want to fanboy too hard, but this was a bit of a pinch me moment for me on this podcast. I've been a fan of Harry's for probably 10 years now. When I first got started in running in 2016, it was Harry Jones and then also Ethan Newbury, the Ginger Runner, who were the main sources of inspiration for me on YouTube. They were really ahead of the curve when it comes to running content creation, and I highly recommend you go and check out Harry's early YouTube videos to get a sense of, you know, where he got started and what the running scene was like back then. One of the things that has really impressed me about Harry for so long is that he's just been in this game for such a long time. He's still young, he's still in his 30s, but he's still running really strong races when a lot of people who he was sharing start lines with back in the mid-2010s are really nowhere to be seen anymore. So I wanted to find out more about that, what he chalks his consistency up to, but also get into the Arc of Attrition and what this race meant to him. As I say, this conversation was held before the race on the Friday. Harry ended up finishing in fifth place, a really strong run from him at the 50 miler, which sets him up well for the 2026 race season that lies ahead. And I'm sure we're all looking forward to seeing what he gets up to this year. This concludes our Arc of Attrition coverage. We may have a few more guests to come, but this is all of the pre-race conversations done and dusted for the week. So I hope you've enjoyed this mega batch of content. If you have, please let me know. Head to the socials at Run Feet First, or you can comment on the episode wherever you're listening. And make sure you leave a rating as well to help the podcast get noticed. All that remains is for me to thank Petzl for supporting the show. Petzl have been at the forefront of hands-free lighting solutions in running and all other adventure sports for over 50 years. They're trusted by a roster of UK runners. You saw many Petzls being worn at this weekend's Arc of Attrition, and they really have lit the way, quite literally, for countless world-class trail running performances. If you want to get your hands on a new Petzl headlamp, then check out their incredible range at the Centurion Ultra Running Store. There'll be a link in the show notes, and whilst you're there, you can use the code FEETFIRST10 to get 10% off your next headlamp with Petzl. That will really help support the podcast, and it will help you light the way on your next trail running adventure. All right, here is Harry Jones. All right, welcome to the Friday live stream of Feet First, here with Harry Jones. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. I've just got here to Cornwall, so I'm looking forward to tomorrow's race.
And we have Harry the dog, who is a little bit obsessed with you at the moment.
Yeah, I think we're best buds now.
Yeah, Harry and Harry. First of all, just want to say it's a real honour to have you on. I've been a huge fan of yours for such a long time. I do want to get into the origin story and the YouTube journey that you've been on and everything. But before we do, if you cast your mind back to when you got started ultra running in Asia, right? Out in Thailand?
Yeah, so I've always been a runner from high school, like classic, like cross-country session, figured out I was quite good at it. Typically one of the smaller people in the class, which obviously helps. And just kind of got headfirst into running from there and loved it. And then ultra running started when I was living in Thailand. I was living in Chiang Mai in the north of Thailand at the time. And if anyone's been there, which I mean, a lot of people know about Chiang Mai now because of the world champs. And then UTMB Thailand is in, they have their big race in Chiang Mai. It's an amazing city, lots going on. But basically we lived at the foot of a huge mountain, Doi Sthep, Doi Pri. And
is that the Monk's Trail?
Lots of people have been there, probably hiked up Monk's Trail. We called it Pilgrim's Trail back in the day. And when I first was living there, it's still quite well known. You'd run up through to the temple and then you could run all the way to the top of the mountain. It's just really wild, really fun and exciting. And basically what started as just kind of weekends exploring there a little bit, enjoying this trail running for the first time. Even though I'd grown up in the mountains, I never competed or thought about it competitively. I'd always just been so obsessed with track running when I was growing up. Just the explorations got longer and longer out there. And then when you get to the point when you're running, you know, for like 4 or 5 hours on a weekend, it kind of felt like, okay, this is something that's quite serious and quite enjoying this. And just started doing some of the local races in Thailand and just gradually went from 50k races up to 100k races, and then kind of went from there, really.
And when you think back to the vibe, I guess, back then, before kind of trail running became this really like global sport that is, you know, got thousands of pounds and millions of pounds behind it. Was the vibe in Southeast Asia like noticeably different to European and North American trail running scene? How has that shaped you as a runner getting started in that part of the world?
Yeah, it's hard to say really. I think for me it was probably a benefit to be out there in my own little bubble. I was quite lucky at the time. I had loads of friends who were there as cyclists, and cycling is really popular in Thailand. I think it might even be, I'm not sure if it's regarded as a national sport, but they have really big cycling events. It's really pushed by the government there in terms of like a health initiative. But there was just lots of really, really strong athletes there at the time, some from Europe, some from America, and then Thai friends as well, cycling up Doicetep, the mountain on the roads there. The roads are so smooth. So I was just really lucky to be in an environment where I had lots of really fit people around me and just to train with. With the running as well, there's lots of people exploring. But yeah, in terms of the racing scenes, it's hard for me to really say because I obviously wasn't in Europe racing trail races at the time, and I've never been to America. But in Thailand, there was always just a really good energy, positive atmosphere in any of the races I did. I think at the time when I was starting out in Thailand, at least, there was maybe one or two major races, and one of them was the North Face 100 in South Thailand, which is very flat and very fast, but you'd be racing in like 40 degrees heat. So it was just crazy. And then there was another one that started up, which wasn't a massive event, but that was really what got me thinking about the sport at a serious level. Was the it's called the Thailand Ultra Marathon. I think they only held it two times, both of which times I was lucky enough to do it. But the first time they had to shorten the course, so it ended up being 80k, which I'm very grateful for, because I just wasn't ready to do 100k that day. I was just walking the last 20k, my feet were killing, and I was loving every moment of it, because we were running through these really remote villages in the mountains of far north Thailand, and it was just spectacular. And then the second time I did it, they actually invited Timothy Olsen over, which was an amazing experience, because then I got to race with him, and I was just chatting with him the whole way around. And I think that brought a lot of exposure to what trail running in Thailand could be. But yeah, it very much grew very fast over there in Asia. Hong Kong was probably at the forefront of that. Hong Kong's just got trails everywhere, and their racing scene was already really well established. And I think Hong Kong really kind of probably spurred it on for the rest of, well, kind of creeping across to the rest of maybe Southeast Asia then.
And I know you've just raced in Hong Kong again. How was it going back to taking the win at Translanta?
It was great. I mean, you can often, I don't know, I feel like I often look back at my life over there. It's almost like a different lifetime, even though it wasn't that long ago when I still lived there. I think it was 2019 when I probably moved, 2019 when I moved back to the UK as a more permanent basis. So it's only a span of 5 years, and probably the, well, probably 2018 was the last time I'd raced in Hong Kong before that. But yeah, it was brilliant to be back over there. It's such an interesting city, and the landscape's incredible. And Lantau Island is really quite wild in its own little way. But the trails are just brutal, and it's all very much, it's either very rough and rugged trails, or it's steps, as you've probably heard in Hong Kong. So there's no switchbacks or anything like that. If you're going up, you're going straight up. Which is, it's a fun style of race, and it's really quite brutal, but it's incredibly, incredibly fun.
Yeah, not a million miles. I mean, the temperature and the humidity is very different to the UK, but not a million miles away from some of the fell and trail running scenes here, right? Where you don't get nice, smooth, you know, runnable trail. You get a lot of gnarly terrain.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's definitely different over here, of course, on our mountains, because they're not quite as built up in terms of the pathways. It depends where you are, of course, but. But yeah, definitely just the scene in Hong Kong. Again, it's just a very interesting trail running scene, because you've got lots of guys who race most weekends. So they race a lot.
Yeah.
But it's quite interesting within the community. It's so tight knit because everyone sees each other so often. They don't have to travel more than an hour and two to a different trail somewhere in Hong Kong, because there's just so many. And yeah, so it's really awesome community, and it's very welcoming. And the racing is just hard, and it's fun.
We've seen like a real surge, I guess, in the dominance of Asian athletes now in the West. People like Fu Zhao Zhang and Hao Ha. You've obviously seen the talent pool they have there from the inside. Is it a surprise to you? Or I guess you were kind of clued up to the fact that they've got some great talent, and it was only a matter of time until they started having strong performances here.
Yeah, for sure. I think I'm still surprised, but I guess I'm not, because it's very difficult for Chinese athletes, I imagine, to travel all the way to Europe. It's very expensive. But yeah, when I first raced in Hong Kong, it was the Hong Kong 100, which is this weekend, I believe, which is a very I think the course has changed now, but when I was racing it was just so fast, and it was quite interesting because it really, I think from my perspective at least, it showed me where the sport was going in some regards. Right. Even though the Chinese maybe weren't winning, the Chinese athletes weren't winning the races every time because they still had lots of international runners coming through, you could just see the focus and the determination that those guys had and brought to racing, and it was really quite impressive. Whereas maybe a lot of Europeans and American races, we kind of start off a bit more chilled out, a bit more relaxed. The Chinese athletes from the start were really setting the pace hard and was like, we're going for this.
Yeah.
And with a race like that race as well, where there's big sections of it which are really fast and really runnable, it was the first time I'd seen athletes racing on trails in road shoes, as in like super shoes. Because
yeah.
I think it was probably the years when, well, the first Vaporfly from Nike or whatever came out, the 4%. And you'd had athletes from China wearing those with Vibram Mega Grip on the bottom, which they got sorted out. And it made sense. And so it was really quite amazing because in terms of racing and the attitude towards racing, which we see now on an international level ever, it's all got a lot faster. Maybe in some sense they were pioneering that approach of just pushing the limits from the start and seeing who could hold on.
Yeah.
Didn't always work out for everyone, but still doesn't now, I guess.
No, yeah, it's amazing how much it's changed. I mean, I want to get into that actually, because when you got started, like being a pro ultra runner was a pretty rare thing. There's probably only a handful of people in the world who could claim that they were full-time ultra runners. Now we've got quite a bit more people on the scene. It's still small compared to other sports, but do you feel like the sport runs the risk potentially of, as athletes are professionalizing, of getting a bit more clinical perhaps, or getting a little bit more structured and losing that soul, or do you feel like that soul is very much still intact?
There's definitely portions of it which probably would benefit the athletes if they were more structured.
Yeah.
In terms of the support for athletes, and obviously the level of professionalism as a trail runner is such a big range and scale, and so like, you know, two athletes on the same start line who are very much similar in performance capability, but maybe one of them's a lot more savvy with the sponsor side of it, or has an agent or something like that. Whereas the other guy is very much more mountain man who just wants to get out there and have the support to be able to do that from a sponsor. So it's a big, like any sport, you know, it's a big range, I guess, of the support that people receive. But it's great to see that more people are able to get the support that they need at a level to be able to do the races they want to do internationally. Because I think for a long time, you've seen a lot of incredible UK runners that are out there, that we know are out there on the trail, on the fell running scene maybe, who could make that transition to the trails but just don't have the backing or the finances to be able to explore what that could do, that could mean in Europe in the ultra running scene or elsewhere, and that's probably still the case. But
you've got to wonder what someone like Billy Bland back in the day, if he'd been able to go and race, I don't know, Western States or something at his peak.
Yeah, maybe. I mean he'd probably hate that style of race though, wouldn't he? So And it's the same now. I'm not going to throw names out there because I don't put anyone on the spot, but there's incredible British athletes on the fell running scene who are just doing phenomenal things, which you just won't see at Western States or UTMB Mont Blanc because of their, well, because of their beliefs and fundamentals.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love that too. And that's what makes fell running special too, is because there are a lot of guys there who, you know, would just do incredible things on this international scene, but they're just not interested on it. And they just love being in the mountains. And I really respect that.
I mean, there's almost like a Barclay-esque quality to that scene, where it's like, if I was to go and try and interview some of these guys and shine a light on the sport, it would be like, that's not what you're meant to do. Like, that's not what it's about.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to them. So yeah, probably it's just a mixed bag like anything, isn't it?
Yeah.
And maybe we'll see more and more runners from the fell running scene coming into the space, but who knows?
Do you feel like, I know you're a coach as well and an athlete, do you feel like the standard for what is considered competitive has changed at all in the time that you've been in the sport? Do you think it's still possible for like someone who's self-coached, or someone who's kind of more of a weekend warrior with a full-time job, to still be competitive at, you know, an event like Arc of Attrition, for instance?
Yeah, I think so, for sure. Definitely. I don't think you need to have all the time in the world to train for ultras. I think people would be really surprised if they're not racing ultras right now, but they're considering it, how much little they do need to change. Say if they were already at a reasonable level or racing short races, obviously you need to maybe put more focus into the longer runs.
Yeah.
But you don't have to do a ridiculous volume of training to perform at an incredible level. Like, I mean, so there's levels to everything, but on a personal note, like I don't do an incredible number of hours of training, but what I do with my coach Martin Cox is we just structure it with a lot of focus and intent as to when I do go hard and what those long runs look like at the right part of the season. For sure, in the summer there's probably big weeks in there, absolutely, but all year round I'm not maxing out my time or my volume.
Yeah, I mean, I want to talk about consistency actually at some point, because it's something that is like really pertinent to you. But one thing I was curious about was the sponsorship landscape. I know you're sponsored by Merrill and Janji, who you share with this podcast. You've over the years you've balanced like your coaching business, your racing, and your content creation on YouTube and things like that. Do you feel like the sponsorship landscape, just for you personally, has like, how has that evolved and changed over the years? When you think back to those first conversations you had with potential sponsors to now, how has that changed at all as for you as an individual?
Yeah, it seems like there's more opportunities because there's more brands, and there's more brands that are supporting athletes, which is fantastic to see. It's maybe a little bit more competitive as well. Yeah. Maybe you have to think out of the box a little bit more rather than just kind of maybe back in the day. I mean, it's hard to know because I never really discussed it with many people. I just kind of went my own direction and was very lucky to land on my feet with a few brands with products that I was already using. And it was just a partnership that made sense. And I was very fortunate to be in the right place at the right time or have someone maybe from the Asian scene that was vouching for me with a shoe sponsor on a smaller level, but then it got into the hands of someone who could actually support me within that business and that brand moving forward to when I wanted to race more in Europe. But on the same flip note, I was really lucky with kind of the content side of things early on. I was very myself and my partner Louise, and we had a YouTube channel. Well, we have a YouTube channel, and we put a lot more focus into that perhaps before, more regularly, and was able to that was a big help for me in terms of maybe enticing sponsorship on board early on when there maybe wasn't a lot of sponsorship on offer for at least any UK athlete at the time, where the market's maybe a lot smaller than somewhere like the US.
Just a quick break to thank Trailskin for supporting the podcast. Trailskin make high-performance skincare products designed for runners by runners. They have an incredible roster of ambassadors on their books who test and trial all of their products, which means that whether you're grinding through your latest ultra marathon or you're just hitting the hills chasing your daily dose of freedom, you can rest assured that your Trailskin product is going to look after your feet and your skin. If you want to get your hands on some Trailskin for yourself and give it a go, then you can head to trailskin.com and you can use the code FEETFIRST20 whilst you're there to get 20% off your next order, minimum order of £20, and you'll get £5 store credit back towards your second order. Try it. Your feet will thank you. I promise you that. That's trailskin.com and use the code FEETFIRST20. All right, back to Harry Jones. Let's talk about YouTube then, because you were one of the early adopters of ultra running YouTube content. You're quite unique in that, because you're not just a content creator, but you're also an elite athlete and you've been winning races. What was it that way back in the day, 2014 sort of time, 2013, what got you thinking about YouTube as a medium you wanted to explore?
Yeah, basically I just enjoyed watching various people on YouTube. Maybe it's because I was in Thailand and didn't have a TV because it was all in Thai, so I didn't understand much of it. I don't spend a lot of time watching programs on TV anyway, so I quite enjoyed following individuals' adventures or running channels or what have you. And the channel really just started off as a way just to show family and friends back home what I was up to, and what the things I was seeing, the things I was experiencing. And then it very quickly kind of morphed into, oh, I'm doing this ultra running thing now. Let's just tell people about, shout about it, because I was really excited by the sport and just thought it's the best thing ever, and I still do. I just wanted to get more people interested and meet more people who enjoyed that kind of thing, really, because I kind of was out there on my own. I had friends, obviously, but I was in Thailand. It wasn't like I was in the UK and could like call up all my mates in the fell running scene and go, oh yeah, it's gonna be a bit epic mountain run. So it's quite a cool way just to kind of connect out there with lots of people and to share my adventures online. And then I guess that just kind of grew and the people were enjoying it, which was and still is very humbling to know, because I was always just trying to just be honest, really, and reflect what I was doing. And in terms of the elite side of it, that was just it was a surprise that I could actually do this and perform at a high level internationally. I never expected that when I started the YouTube channel was just, hey, I'm running on this trail today. It's probably some shaky footage of me going down some crazy jungle trail in Chiang Mai, and then you pop out some temple. So it was all very like fun to film anyway, because for someone growing up in North Wales, it's a very different environment to be living in. So it was very easy to get a camera out and talk to it and show people. But yeah, it was just, I think it was just right time, right place, and just lucky enough to have some nice support of people early on who enjoyed it, and yeah, kind of spiraled from there, I guess.
It's probably very hard to say, but how much success or how much sponsorship and how different do you think your professional career would be had you not been investing in that content creation? Is it, do you have a sense of where the line is between those two things?
I have no idea how to draw that line, because I know that there's probably sponsors I've had in the past that have, yeah, primarily been with me because of that side of the market, which maybe they just weren't reaching with in terms of their own content creation, which it blows my mind that lots of brands still don't get it right, it seemingly, on platforms like YouTube, when it's really not difficult if you just hire a filmographer or what have you, just to or videographer, follow someone around for a day and show the training, and if that person can be comfortable with the camera being on them and being honest with what they're up to, because people just enjoy watching stuff. It might not be for everyone, but there'll be a big section of people that do enjoy it and learn things from it perhaps, or just get inspired by it. I think it's definitely better now. I think lots of brands are obviously performing that really well. Lots of brands have almost gone backwards with how effective they are with that strategy, which is bizarre. But yeah, I don't really know how to equate it. I'd like to think that I still would have landed on my feet with performances I'd had, which was a lot of early on in terms of the back in the day of the Ultra Trail World Tour. A lot of that was self-funded adventure as well. I didn't have a lot of funds behind me, but I was very lucky to just be so passionate about it. That's where all the saving went, was just to get into the next race and then living out the suitcase for a bit and get into the next race. And it was just a passion project, I guess, that I fortunately still able to do.
That's so cool. I get very nostalgic sometimes for like 2016, 2017 era trail running, even the aesthetics of like the way the packs looked and the way that there's a lot more color in the way like the people dressed and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, in one sense, I kind of miss it, because it was, as a professional, it was a lot simpler when you had that Ultra Trail World Tour as an ultra trail professional. There was maybe 8 races, and it was like, that's, you aim for those races.
Yeah.
Now there's just so much going on. It's obviously, there's still an obvious path with it, and you know, obviously that path all leads to UTMB, it seems, in the summer. But part of me does miss the way it was before, when it was just, you'd see a lot more of the pros going head to head a lot more often, perhaps. Maybe it wasn't sustainable for some athletes, but it was cool.
And it kind of still people figuring out what worked. You know, you had people who were still trying like low carb, people who were barefoot runners, people who, like, there was so much more variety, whereas now it does feel like there's still variety, but it's like most people are doing high carb, you know, most people are wearing some kind of super shoe or something like that. The diversity in the sport has narrowed a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that, I guess that comes with the top performances that we see.
We found out what works, basically.
Yeah, there's a pretty obvious pattern as to what works. And as well, the sport is old enough now to, old enough in the sense of social media and people being open about their journey within the sport, to see who lasts the longest and in terms of sustainability as an athlete and performance. And so I think we're learning a little bit more about how to go about that. And how people can sustain high quality performance over time.
For sure. One thing I was going to ask about YouTube is, it's a bit like the racing scene. YouTube itself has kind of professionalized quite substantially. You have a lot more YouTubers. And it feels like in trail running, the model is moving away from this kind of brand centric approach where you had like Salomon TV or whatever it was, to more of a personal brand thing. When you think about what David Roach was doing in the build up to Western States, things like that. And obviously you have been kind of ahead of that curve for quite a while. Just how do you feel about like balancing that need to kind of be a personality, as it were, or a content creator with, you know, your full-time work as an athlete, a coach, and now a dad and having a family?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm honest, like it does feel like a lot sometimes. And before being a dad, it was a lot easier to manage all those things, perhaps. Even though I was kind of, as you said, maybe ahead of the curve with the YouTube stuff, and maybe it didn't I don't know, it's hard to say, but like getting in front of a camera and like talking about what I'm up to is not something that comes very natural to me, because I'm very much more of a kind of person who just enjoys just getting on with it and not shouting about it from the rooftops, which I think like a lot of athletes, probably runners maybe, naturally are, because we're not really the kind of people who are like mega out there, look at me. I mean, obviously everyone's different, but yeah, so that's something that I do have to work on, and at times within my career I have maybe not done enough of, because I'm focused on the performance, focused on the training, trying to take things to the next level like everyone else, and really develop in that side of things. And sometimes you do need to maybe take a break from the demands of stopping mid-run, talking to the camera 5 minutes center, running back and forth. And like early on in YouTube, there was a lot of that faffing around, and it was before I had a decent camera, so I used to do a lot of the filming. It was a great camera, still very portable, but a Canon G7X, which isn't an action camera, but it performed brilliantly. But yeah, a lot of like trying to balance that on rocks in the middle of, I don't know, wherever it was, in the mountains with the wind and everything else, and dropping it and breaking it. And so a lot of going up and down to do that, whereas now it's a lot easier now. You just set a drone up and have it follow you for 5 minutes, and then do some different poses. What, you've got something to clip together. I don't know. So yeah, I think the access to doing that now is a lot easier, which is great, because as a professional athlete, you do want to focus on your training. You don't want to think about stopping and faffing. And obviously there's times to do that and there's times not to do that, but it's great because it's easier than ever to probably do it if you're organized. And it's an exciting, I think it's a better way about it in some regards. I think brands still should have, well, I can't say what brands should or shouldn't do, but it's great when brands do put the
investment
behind an athlete to make a good video series. Because if an athlete's left up to it, it's just going to be a vlog, unless they are someone who's already very capable on the camera or has a lot of time outside of their training, and it's a very time consuming thing. And as an athlete, you should be focusing on your performance more than anything.
So
it's best of both worlds, really. And I think it's great if it is left in the athlete's hand in one sense to build their brand, because hopefully that leaves them in a better position maybe when they do move out of the sport onto something else. Maybe it's still within the sport, but from a different capacity, like Dylan Bowman, maybe a Free Trail podcast. They've got an audience to be able to shout to the world about what they're up to.
I kind of, your Janji teammate Ricky Gates is a big hero of mine, and I feel like he's done a great job of kind of transitioning out of being at the elite end of the sport, but still being a storyteller in some sense and exploring that side of things.
Absolutely, like anything that went on Solomon TV with Ricky, I loved it. Like his motorbike adventures, and then like just the way he's talking about the landscape and connecting with it, and it's just obviously coming from a very real place. And very good on camera, very good at storytelling, but not someone who would be on social media every day shouting about it.
No,
just quality content at the right time.
100%. Well, let's talk about the arc of attrition. So you've just come off a really solid race at Translantau, which was like a month ago. So I guess my open question is, why this race?
Last year I think I was watching it or following along with the race, and it was great to see so many UK athletes really giving it a good go, and seeing everyone line up early on in the year. I think last year I was down to do Trans Gran Canaria, but I had had Achilles tendinopathy over the winter, so I just really couldn't. I was running, but I wasn't able to really put any much quality in. I was just kind of letting that heal up. So I had to pull out of both of those races in the end. I had to pull out of TGC. But whilst ARC was going on, I definitely felt like I wanted to be on the start line next year. I do love racing in the UK. It's brilliant. And it's great just to be on the start line with lots of strong UK athletes early season as well. So it's kind of cool to get racing in January, kind of see where you're at, and then move for the rest of the year like that, I think.
Yeah, it's funny. We get this like double bill of the spine and the arc in January, and then it's February and March. It's just like nothing. Well, I guess you got Trans Gran Canaria and things. But,
well, not this year.
But to watch as a fan. This race is like notoriously kind of bitty. It's not super technical all the time, but there's a mix of technicality. It's going to be really muddy this year as well. I know you live in South Wales now, so how has training been, and how easily can you sort of replicate the conditions that you're going to face?
Yeah, so I live in Cardiff, South Wales. I think Cardiff's an amazing city to train in. There's lots of local trails, lots of local smaller hills, and then kind of the further you get away from Cardiff, the hills just get bigger.
Yeah.
But for this training, I've kind of been doing a lot of my long runs in an area called Cwm Carn, which is, I guess it's an old colliery area. So lots of reasonable size hills. I think maybe 300 meters or so is probably the biggest climb. So the climb's probably bigger than I needed to do down here. But at the same time, it's just lots of small little trails around there. And it's almost, there's a bit of zigzagging around to kind of convolute a kind of 4 or 5 hour run. But the whole time you're away from traffic, you're on, because you're going up and down these kind of valleyed kind of folds in the hills. So you're very much, feels like you're really out there in nature, but you're maybe 20 minutes from a road at any one time. But it's really nice. But at the same time, it's a lot lower than the Brecon Beacon. So I didn't have to worry about ice or snow or anything this time of year if I was to be up there training. So it was a good place, I think, for this race where I could get some reasonable long, moderate runs in on muddy, small, kind of choppy trails like we're expecting on the weekend, and some fast, flowy bits too. So hopefully it works. We'll see. But I think it was a better idea for me than training the Brecon Beacons where I do all my summer training.
Feels like Cardiff would be a great place to have like an urban ultra. Like, is there one that like heads out onto the hills and back or something?
Yeah, I mean, that seems like there's more and more events popping up around there, but there's some cool events. There's Brecon to Cardiff along the Taff Trail. I guess that's more of a road ultra almost.
Yeah.
There's a bit of trail because you start on Canal Path. I never raced it, but you start on the Canal Path in Brecon, I believe, and then you join Taff Trail, and you've got a bit of gravelly section there around some of the reservoirs before you head through Merthyr Tydfil, and then it's kind of downhill then to Cardiff.
Right.
So that's quite cool looking kind of early season ultra that people do. And now they've actually got one that does head up over, you're basically running up and down over the valleys onto your way into Cardiff. So they do like the road Taff Trail side one, and then the same day to do more of the mountainous version.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, out of Cardiff itself, there are some smaller trail races that kind of start in Forest Fawr, I believe. Maybe shorter, not quite ultras, but yeah, you could do some cool races as like an urban ultra from Cardiff.
Something to explore. You're going into this race as the third ranked man, according to the mysterious and very confusing UTMB index. How are you feeling about the competition and the people you've got your eye on?
I mean, it's got to be Chris Jones. He's got my eye on Chris, of course. I mean,
you say I'd say the underdog. Obviously, he's not the underdog, but his UTMB index perhaps doesn't reflect how strong he is in this distance.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably his first time at this distance. Why, I think, but he, you know, he's obviously done extremely well in OCC, World Championship races, and in every discipline, I believe, of running. So yeah, Chris is, this shouldn't be a massive step up from, I would imagine, compared to OCC. Mm. Yeah, Chris is obviously, he knows how to train, and he seemingly trains really well, and always turns up to a race, and it seems like he always performs. So yeah, Chris will be the man to keep an eye on, I guess. And then who's second after Chris?
Keith Wigley.
Keith. Keith raced last year, didn't he? And he had a good strong day. I think did he have a bad fall as well or something? Or
I don't know if he fell. He was with Tom and Hugh for a long time, and he just fell off the pace a bit.
Keith's been doing brilliant this last few years. I think I met him face to face, but he came
third at UTS.
Yeah, UTS. So I think I bumped into him before, but yeah, Keith is obviously done amazingly well these past few years in terms of development. So yeah, excited to race with Keith. I don't think we've raced before, so it'll be good fun.
Yeah, he was looking forward to racing with you yesterday. So one thing I obviously have to ask about, I guess, is the Arc of Attrition being now a UTMB World Series event. It was a big talking point last year. I think people have kind of accepted it, those who had issues with it. But you've raced like a lot of sort of indie ultras as well as like big flagship events. How are you feeling about, like, I guess, the Cornish spirit or the independent spirit of the event sort of carrying through as into the UTMB era?
It's hard for me to say because it's my first time at ARC, so I'll let you know after the weekend, I guess. But it seems like, I mean, there's not a lot they can change, really, I guess. I would hope that the local communities don't see a negative. In fact, it being a UTMB event, I don't think they probably do. Probably a positive because there's probably more people running it now. I would hope that it is maintained as local spirit. I believe that, like any of the UTMB races, when it made that change, that was something that was a core value that they wanted to hang on to, and I'm sure they have. So I'm looking forward to it. I mean, Cornwall used to come down here for my summer holidays, camping trips, a bit of surfing with my brothers and my family as a kid. So there'll be a few places along the way which might seem familiar from then. So I look forward to it.
We went for a short run this morning, about 4 miles, which really put into perspective what 50 or 100 miles is going to feel like. But we actually saw some people surfing today, which was completely mind-blowing here in January.
Yeah,
tough. They're tough down here.
I used to get cold in the summer in a wetsuit, so no way I could do that.
Well, the one thing I want to talk about is also consistency, because, you know, a lot of elites, not naming any names, but a lot of elites seem to sort of burn out after 2, 3, maybe 4 years in the sport. Whereas you've kind of been at the sharp end more or less for over 10 years. Can you chalk this up to anything in particular? Do you have a sense of what's contributed to that?
I think early on it was just, before I got into the ultra stuff when I was in Thailand, I'd raced track up until the end of university, and then had a bit of a break really from any structured training for a reasonable period of time. Maybe it was like 5 years before I started racing again when I was living in Thailand. So I think that break was nice. It was almost like coming back into the sport fresh, with fresh intentions, even though it's a different sport, trail running compared to running around the track in circles. But yeah, in terms of longevity, so maybe that helped initially, but in terms of longevity, I think it was just enjoy being in the mountains more than anything. And early on, I just kind of said, you know, this is almost like your second life in running. I just wanted to focus on races and style of racing that I enjoyed and thought was fun, rather than putting myself through the stress of trying to get a second PB if I was lucky throughout a year, you know, over 1500 meters, which was something that probably made me just fall out of love with running. Just the stress of track racing all the time is a beautiful sport. I'm really glad that I came into running through that avenue, because you learn a lot in terms of training and philosophy within the sport. But yeah, I just love more of the kind of the balance between the landscape dictating performance as much as your training, in terms of times and distances and everything else, being out there on the trails. So yeah, trail racing is fun for me just because it's always an adventure. And I think that mindset thing of it has just allowed me just to be to be consistent within the sport for so many years. But also early on, there was a few years of just crazy unsustained. I think, you know, just like everyone, I've been through the vigors of just doing training blocks, which were just crazy looking back on them now. And they probably worked for one or two races, but then quite quickly it's like, okay, this isn't sustainable.
Sure.
And then I guess these past few years working with Martin, my coach, has helped me just to stay focused and maintain a belief in what is the right training for me, to stay within the sport for a long time, because I would hate to not be able to do it and not to be able to do it to what I believe is my best performance on the day.
That track background, does that still come through in your ultra running experience? I'm thinking of like a lot of ultra runners, particularly maybe slightly more old school ultra runners, they might think what is fast is a certain pace, but if you're a track athlete, you know what fast really means, you know what pushing yourself really means on the speed side.
Yeah, for sure. Like when I look back now, I don't understand how I did the sessions I did at the time, and it really was, I think I was kind of blessed in one sense that I had good coaches around me, but at the same time I'm glad that they kind of kept me at bay really, because I was always wanted more in training. And it was just there were seasons where you do a track session, I'd be at the side of the track after every session, either throwing up or trying not to, because the body was just in shock, because you can push yourself so hard in those track sessions when you're so young and you're mad. But yeah, when I look back now, I don't know how I did it, but yeah, I'm glad I had those years, because yeah, it kind of sets your higher level maybe a little bit higher in terms of what you can do out there in training. But yeah, I would say training now is it's not quite, it's intense obviously, but in a different way, and I enjoy that as well, because get to do the sessions that I enjoy more naturally now, as opposed to the sprint work and everything else as you do as a middle distance runner.
Yeah. And how has the why changed over the years when you think back to like all those races you were doing in Thailand and what was driving you then to now going to race on a drizzly Saturday in January in Cornwall? Is there any changes there now that you're slightly older, you know, you've got a child and things?
Yeah, I think the why is still the same. Like I just said a few minutes ago, I feel like we're really fortunate with ultra racing, because I don't think there's many times in modern day life now where you can really just Oh, yeah. Unless you're a single guy, maybe, who lives in the mountains and you have no other responsibilities or family to worry about. But there's not a lot of times in modern society now where you can literally say, I'm not going to be available at all for the next 50 miles, 100 miles, whatever it'll be on race day, when you can really just put your phone away and not even think about it, and just be you and the hills and the trail in front of you. And then to do that within a race situation, as someone who loves racing and trying to get the most out of myself, obviously when you're in a race, that's what you're doing. So it's great, because you can never, I can never get as much out of myself as I can on race day if I was just out there solo. So it's just the adventure of it and just the escape from reality and being able to just feel like you're having some epic adventure whilst you're in Cornwall or you know, it's not like you're in the Himalayas or anything like that, but you know, the adventure ahead of you is incredible when you're racing with others, and the camaraderie that you can get within that short space of time by sharing 2 hours or 3 hours with another runner when you're both going through pain and suffering to move through the landscape fast is great. It's cool.
Nice. Obviously the sport's growing a lot. It's really accelerating in some sense. There's a lot of people coming into the sport. A lot of listeners to this show are kind of brand new to the sport. So if you could go back to talk to Harry in 2013 and offer him some words of wisdom, what would they be?
Probably just chill out. I think I wouldn't change anything. I'm definitely pleased with the route I took, because it meant that, I think if I started in Europe, I think maybe I probably wouldn't have progressed as much as I have, because I probably would have been in more situations where I wasn't maybe at the front of an ultra trail field, or wasn't able to feel what it was like to perform well or to race in the landscapes that I did. And I'm pleased that it went the way it did, but I definitely needed just to take my foot off the gas pedal a little bit sometimes. Didn't need to quite be running up the mountain at 3 a.m. in the morning or anything like that. So yeah.
Nice. Well, Harry, I'm super excited to see how your race unfolds. I think it's going to be really, really fascinating to watch. We always close the show with the same question, which is, what do you think is the most important thing when it comes to success in ultra running?
It's obviously not necessarily your result on any given day. It's maybe parts back to what we've been talking about, just sustainability. And if it's something that you love and you really want to continue doing because of the fun and enjoyment and being out there on the trails, then definitely just make sure you're training in a sustainable way, because if you're getting that year-on-year growth without any injuries or many major setbacks, which obviously come as a result of pushing the boundaries too far too often, so listen to the body and just having everything in balance is the best way forward, and just fine-tuning things as you go along.
Nice one, Harry Jones, thanks so much.
Thank you.